The following podcast is produced following the workshop Chinese Objects Outside of China, which took place at Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library from June 5th to June 9th, 2017. The workshop is part of the Chinese Object Study Workshops program, administered by the Freer Gallery of Art and the Arthur M. Sackler Gallery, the Smithsonian Museums of Asian Art, and sponsored by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. During this workshop, we pondered the question of how to understand Chinese export objects, objects made in China but traded and purchased around the world, particularly in the European and American markets. We could ask questions like, is it Chinese or is it American? But objects, like people, don't fit into neat categories. Their biographies contain multiple genealogies, and as they cross boundaries of geography, culture, and time, new chapters are added to that biography. So let's start thinking about Chinese export objects within global history instead. With that in mind, our fearless workshop leaders randomly assigned us a mystery object and asked us to tell its story. So here we go. What we have here is a porcelain tureen stand about 11.5 inches in diameter with an eye-dazzling decorative design, a central motif of three overlapping pomegranates over a decorative design known as tobacco leaf. The lobed and scalloped rim give the porcelain body the impression of a flower in bloom, in form visually echoing the flowers enameled upon its surface. The shape also recalls another natural form, seashells, which resonates with the whiteness of the porcelain body. This is one of a pair in the Winterthur collection. At first, we might think that these are plates, but by looking at similar examples in other collections, we know that most likely, at some point in their lives, our pair also had a set of pomegranate-shaped tureens, making these tureen stands. Sadly, we no longer have a record of what those pomegranate-shaped tureens would have looked like. Porcelain, tobacco, pomegranates. What do these have to do with each other? Why combine them into a single object? As we consider the history of porcelain, tobacco, and pomegranates, we see that this tureen stand serves as a material witness to the intersection of global networks of production, circulation, and consumption in the 18th century. Let us begin by closely examining the materiality and techniques of production in the stand itself. We have a white porcelain body whose lobed form was made in a mold by the potters at Jingdezhen in Jiangxi Province, China's center for porcelain production. In contrast to earthenware and stoneware, porcelain is a high-fired, vitrified, translucent white ceramic. When fired at temperatures up to 1400 degrees Celsius, the molecular structure of the clay forms a crystalline structure, making it possible for the porcelain to be simultaneously very light and very strong. You can try this experiment if you have some porcelain on hand. Shine a laser pointer at it. You should be able to see the red dot on the other side of the porcelain wall. This is because the molecular structure allows light to pass through. You can also look at examples of very fine Chinese imperial porcelain, where the porcelain body is barely thicker than an eggshell. You can see right through the white body to the overglaze enamels on the outside. What's the secret to this? There were some who thought that the clay mixture needed to be buried underground for centuries. Others wondered if the secret ingredient was bone or shells. The actual secret to porcelain's material properties lies in the native kaolin clay and porcelain stone mined upriver from the kilns at Jingdezhen. European scientists would not figure this out until 1708, and that was because the Prince Elector of Saxony, Augustus the Strong, literally locked up the alchemist Johann Friedrich Böttger until Böttger figured out the chemical composition to make porcelain. Let us move from the porcelain body to the enameled surface. We know that the tobacco leaf and pomegranate design was intended from the beginning. Their outlines are completed in underglaze blue, which would have been fired at the same time as the porcelain body. By the 18th century, the Jingdezhen potters sourced cobalt domestically, but the origins of underglaze blue come from Persian cobalt. The development of blue and white porcelain in the Yuan and Ming dynasties was a direct result of close trade relations with the Middle East, whose populace really liked the effect of brilliant blue on a white surface. The pastel pinks, greens, and yellows of the pomegranate and tobacco leaf pattern are an enamel palette, later known as famille rose. Jesuit missionaries working for the Qing emperors introduced the technique of using colloidal gold to create new colors around 1728. We don't often associate the 18th century with nanotechnology, but this is exactly that. The suspension of gold nanoparticles in the glaze formula, where different sizes of the nanoparticles can produce different colors. These softer pastel hues were eminently suited to the depiction of flowers, fruits, and the natural world. To further imitate the natural appearance of a pomegranate, the enamel artist did not stop at the choice of colors, but also used the technique of blowing the pink enamel through a gauze-covered bamboo rod in order to achieve the mottled, splotchy texture of pomegranate skin. Finally, the combination of dark underglaze blue, overglaze iron red, and gold gilding imitates the colors of Emari porcelain from Japan. Early Emari was introduced to Japan by Korean potters in the 16th century who were familiar with Chinese porcelain practices. During the turbulent years of the Ming-Qing transition in the mid-17th century, Japanese kilns took advantage of the lessened Chinese presence in the export market and created a taste for Japanese Emari porcelain in the West. Soon after, Chinese potters would imitate these Japanese styles to reclaim a share of the market. Taken all together, then, we have a terrine stand whose body is formed of Chinese clay and whose surface testifies to the exchange of materials, technologies, and styles all across Eurasia. Tobacco leaf designs appear only on export ceramics, not on vessels produced for domestic Chinese use. The basic design features broad, colorful, serrated leaves and bright flowers. It was a popular design in the mid to late 18th century for Western purchasers. The production of tobacco leaf porcelain takes place in several steps. First, high temperature firing of the porcelain body and underglaze blue. Second, the low temperature firing of the overglaze enamels. And finally, adding a touch of gold around the rim. The showiness of the design immediately proclaims its laborious production process and thus loudly announces the owner's wealth at being able to afford such extravagant tableware. Porcelain is the earliest truly global trade good, but tobacco follows close behind and spread around the world in a few short decades. The tobacco plant grows native to the Americas, where it's traditionally used by indigenous peoples in religious ritual. The Spanish introduced tobacco to Europe in the 1570s, touting its medicinal properties. In 1575, they brought tobacco to the Philippines to be farmed as a cash crop. It soon entered China around 1600, along with other New World crops, and in 1605, the Portuguese introduced tobacco to India, Java, and Japan. From the Far East, tobacco traveled back west to the Near East and Central Asia. In 1612, English colonists in the Chesapeake Bay grew the first successful crop of tobacco in Virginia. By 1630, tobacco had already circumnavigated the globe as a cash crop and substance for consumption. Everywhere tobacco went, it changed social habits, as local populations picked up smoking the cured leaves or taking it as snuff. Its consumption created new objects of material culture: tobacco pipes, pouches, snuff bottles. By 1700, the Chesapeake colonies and Brazil colonies accounted for nearly all the output of New World tobacco. As a cash crop, tobacco served as the financial foundation of the American colonies and the source of wealth for many of our founding fathers, including George Washington. Inventories of Washington's chinaware show that he owned tobacco leaf porcelain and that he paid for his porcelain with the profits from his tobacco crop. The appeal of tobacco leaf is thus not only because it is eye-catching and expensive, but because it visually announces the very source of wealth that made its purchase possible, making it desirable to plantation owners, but also to the merchants and captains who sold and shipped the product overseas. Some scholars have, however, pointed out that the leaves in a tobacco leaf design are not, in fact, actual tobacco leaves. They correctly note that the leaves of tobacco plants are smooth, not serrated like the ones represented here. What might these actually be represented? One suggestion as to what the leaves are include custard apple, which is a tropical fruit tree, Another suggestion is that the leaf shape comes from patterns in South Asian textiles. I think we can ask the question, but what does it actually represent? All day without arriving at a clear answer. Instead, why don't we ask, is there another way of understanding the popularity of this design without resorting to reductive labels? Let us think about how the design works. Tobacco leaf design is an immensely flexible pattern that can be adapted to any size and any form, as is attested by the many examples of tobacco leaf porcelain in the Winterthur collection. Take a walk around the galleries. Look at all the serving platters, dessert plates, teapots, and teacups that are tobacco leaf design. Its elements can be brought closer together or moved further apart. It allows for many variations. The leaves can be pushed to the edges, serving as a foreground or frame to a romantic garden scene. The leaves can be pushed closer together, leaving just enough of an opening for a scene of a ship in harbor. Or the leaves can close up completely and turn into pure surface pattern of shape and color. Whether the leaves are tobacco or custard apple or some other plant, the broad leaves and fantastical flowers evoke a mysterious tropical land. The overlapping pattern negates linear perspective, our ability to see through and see clearly, but it tempts you with the possibility of access to that distant land. It's as if you were deep in the forest and your vision of the path ahead is blocked by dense foliage. The pattern tempts you. Go ahead, stick your hand out, push the leaves aside, see what mysterious land, potentially full of riches, is just beyond. The aesthetic of tobacco leaf matches well with a time when explorers, merchants, and naturalists were successfully traveling to the far corners of the world and bringing their experiences and profits back with them. We should note, however, that the aesthetic appeal of tobacco leaf porcelain hides a dark history of exploitation. The tobacco economy of the Americas was sustained by slave labor. Colonial expansion brought misery and death to many indigenous communities. Cargo ships moved along global trade networks, carrying luxury goods like tobacco, sugar, coffee, tea, lacquer, and silks, but they also carried cargoes of enslaved human beings whose labor made the production and consumption of these goods possible. We have raised the possibility that the original referent of tobacco leaf design may not have been an actual tobacco leaf. We've seen that objects move across boundaries, but so do the motifs upon their bodies. The unstable identity of the leaves in tobacco leaf design is one example of how certain forms can be misrepresented or reinterpreted as they move across boundaries. Let us move from the edge of our terrain stand to its center. The pomegranates are unquestionably pomegranates. In the pomegranate, we have an example of a motif whose form remains stable, but it moves easily across cultural and geographic boundaries precisely because its cultural meaning is not fixed. The pomegranate appears to have been around as long as human civilization itself. The plant originates in the geographic area of the Near East to Central Asia. It may have entered China as early as the 1st century BCE, when conquest westwards opened trade routes to Central Asia. It was certainly well known in China by the 8th century, where its red flowers are praised in Tang poetry. The Islamic conquest of the Spanish peninsula brought the pomegranate to Europe, where they even named the city of Granada after the fruit. Spanish settlers would later introduce the pomegranate plant to the Americas. As the pomegranate has established its physical presence around the world, it has also acquired a multitude of cultural meanings. As early as the 8th century BCE, a Syrian woman wore small pomegranate-shaped carvings as fertility talismans. In China, too, the fruit's many seeds easily made it an auspicious symbol for many sons, a reading reinforced by the homophone in Chinese between seed and sun, zi. In Greek myth, Persephone eats some pomegranate seeds while she's the captive of Hades, and thus seals her fate of spending half the year in the underworld. Her return to the world above brings the end of winter and the beginning of spring, and so the pomegranate becomes a symbol of resurrection and rebirth. Christianity picks up the same theme and incorporates the pomegranate into paintings of the Virgin Mary and Child Jesus. The ruby red juice of the pomegranate also symbolizes Christ's sacrifice and the salvation of his body and blood. The pomegranate's unique physical characteristics mean that it is unlikely to be lost in translation and be misread as a different fruit. No other fruit is quite like it, round, red-skinned, with a crown-shaped calyx and jammed full of juicy red seeds. The multitude of possible meanings attached to the pomegranate allows it to move easily across cultural boundaries, and because these symbolic meanings are largely positive, it doesn't encounter much resistance. The many meanings of the pomegranate make a pomegranate tureen and tureen stand an ideal conversation piece for your dinner guests. Just as expanded trade routes and cultivation of cash crops introduce new foods to the plate, Chinese export ceramics changed the topography of the dinner table. By the 18th century, the revolution in dining was well underway. Feasting has always been a way to display wealth, both in terms of the food you serve and in the value of the vessels in which you serve it. European aristocracy used silver, that is, until economic necessity required silver vessels to be melted down in the 17th century. Porcelain stepped in to take silver's place, and that's why many of the forms of export porcelain are derived from metal shapes, like our tureen stand. The material properties of porcelain make it ideal for dining vessels. Unlike metal or glass, porcelain is resistant to thermal shock, meaning you can pour the fashionable hot beverages of tea, coffee, and chocolate into it without fear of burning yourself or of the glass shattering. Porcelain keeps your food warm longer, an important consideration when your kitchen is far removed from your dining room. Porcelain is hygienic, odor-free, and doesn't affect the taste of food. Silver, on the other hand, will react with the natural acids in food and leave an unpleasant metallic aftertaste. Of course, you could always use gold because it's inert, but that's hardly practical or affordable. Food preparation and how food arrived on the table also changed dramatically during this period. Medieval recipes had smothered dishes in heavily spiced sauces. In the 16th century, food itself was the center of attention. Whole roasted swans or peacocks arrived at the table with their vibrant plumage still stuck back into them. But by the mid-17th century, French cooks were revolutionizing cuisine by emphasizing the natural look and taste of foods. This interest in the natural extended to the serving vessels, which were now the center of attention. Formal dining became a spectacle, where you admire the table setting before you ever see the food. Silversmiths in the French court created intricately detailed serving vessels decorated with naturalistic sculptures of popular foods like crayfish and cauliflower. These large silver soup tureens, accompanied by smaller vessels, would be placed in a symmetrical arrangement on the table. This form of table setting became known as service à la française, or service in the French style, where all the dishes of a course arrived at the same time and you helped yourself. Since each vessel now had a specific function, soup tureen, sauce tureen, fruit plate, dessert plate, and so on, dinner services grew in size and complexity. In the 1730s, Germany's Meissen Company was producing the first porcelain dinner services. Just as silversmiths decorated soup tureens with realistically sculpted plants and animals, glazed porcelain services also took on the shape of foodstuffs, but with the added benefit of naturalistic, lifelike color. Take a look at Winterthur's Campbell collection of soup tureens to see examples of serving vessels in the shape of bulls' heads, mother hens, and bunny rabbits. Our pair of pomegranate tobacco leaf tureen stands would only have formed part of a larger dining service. The size of dinner services meant that only the extremely wealthy would have purchased a complete matching set in one go. It's more likely that this pair of stands was purchased to complement an existing tobacco leaf service. The missing pomegranate-shaped tureens would probably have had a tobacco leaf design on its body, and the lid would be decorated with three pomegranates in low relief. Would the tureens have contained pomegranate-related food? Possibly, but likely not. Food historians have noted that there was little relationship between the edibles depicted on the container and the actual dish served within. Regarding a set of blue and white pomegranate-shaped tureens and stands in another collection, William Sargent remarks, quote, "One is tempted to state that these tureens, because of their small size, were used for soups or sauces, or because of their shape, were used for something made with pomegranates. But in truth, they could be used for any function deemed necessary by the owner." The 1781 inventory of Joaquim da Cruz Sobral mentions similar tureens used as butter dishes, end quote. Service in the French style changed the entire sensory experience of eating. Before guests tasted a single thing, their visual appetite was first whetted. Food scientists have now confirmed that what we see can change our perception of how good something tastes, so maybe colorful white porcelain made the food in it taste better. But since a vessel's exterior gave little hint of what it contained inside, your guests are left suspended in anticipation, allowing for a moment of surprise and revelation when the cover is finally lifted. Dinner is served, and conversation resumes, perhaps about the multiple meanings of the pomegranate, or the state of one's tobacco crop, or the latest shipment of fashionable porcelain from China. The biography of an object, however, extends further than the brief lives of its human makers and first owners. This tureen stand may have started life as a piece of tableware, but it will probably never serve sauce again, or be used as a butter dish. Many large dinner services became collectibles in the late 19th and 20th centuries, sought after by men like Henry Francis DuPont, who desired them as items of America's colonial past and a way to link their own industries to the nation-building enterprise begun by the founding fathers. For DuPont, collecting Chinese export ceramics had nothing to do with China, but everything to do with America. This pair of tureen stands, however, do not enter Winterthur through DuPont, but through more recent collectors, Daniel and Serge Nadler. Before the Nadlers, the stands were in the collection of Khalil Risk, who founded the Chinese Porcelain Company in 1984. The collectors of Chinese export porcelain in the later 20th century, unlike those of DuPont's generation, prized the ceramics precisely because of the porcelain's cross-cultural identities, which resonated with their own biographies as individuals born in one place, who have moved to another, and continue to travel back and forth across cultural and geographic boundaries throughout their life. Khalil Risk was born in Lebanon and moved to New York to attend college. Daniel Nadler was born in Egypt, spent time in Japan, and met Serge in Iran. The Nadlers discovered Chinese export porcelain in New England and retired with their collection in New York, where they installed their tobacco leaf porcelain not on the table, but on the wall. The tureen stand now comes to the latest chapter of its biography, as an object in a museum to be used for study by a new generation of researchers who find them fascinating because they are neither only Chinese nor only American, but part of a history about the translation of materials, technologies, motifs, and practices around the world. Thanks for listening. Please check out the other podcasts by my other workshop colleagues.